It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, another exit interview today with the Conservative MP Craig Whittaker, who went from trying to get Liz Truss elected 20 years ago to becoming her deputy chief whip the night her government collapsed. A fascinating interview with him. Before that, the columnists Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on the return of the Coalition of Chaos and their favourite hymn. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Yes, happy coronation day. We're a man who has waited for the top job for years. Finally gets his chance. Just as everyone around him collapses into embarrassing infighting. Ready to be oiled, spooned and crowned, John Swinney. Keen to move on from the era of Queen Nicola and Crown Prince Humza. It's his big day today. And if it's a coronation, Penny Mordaunt's on standby.
The sword of state, which is the heaviest sword, so I've been doing some press-ups to train for that.
How are you celebrating this coronation? Assume you'll be doing it the way the SNP marks all big state occasions. By erecting a Police Scotland gazebo in your front garden.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
And we say hello to Libby Purvis. Hello, Libby.
Hello.
And hello to Rachel Sylvester. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Matt.
Nice to have you both here. Now, this is exciting. This is all politics is getting retro. Oh, it seems after Rishi Sunak has told the Times today, looking at the local elections, he says the results suggest we are heading for a hung parliament with Labour as the largest party. Keir Starmer propped up in Downing Street by the SNP, Liberal Democrats and the Greens will be a disaster for Britain. It's all very retro. It sounds like we're going back to this.
And then there's a sort of coalition of chaos out there that wants more debt, spending and taxes.
We're not going to have a coalition with the SNP, no. No deals.
Or you can choose the economic chaos of Ed Miliband.
Strong and stable leadership with me in the national interest. Or a hung parliament and coalition of chaos under Jeremy Corbyn.
It's the coalition of chaos made flesh these things.
Or you will get Jeremy Corbyn with a hung parliament and a coalition of chaos.
We all look forward to welcoming the Queen's speech just as soon as the coalition of chaos has been negotiated.
Right, so, Libby, this is the latest attempt by the Conservatives to sort of reinsert themselves into the election conversation, drawing on some analysis by Rawlings and Thrasher, which suggested, based on the local election results, we could be heading for a hung parliament. Will this work? Rishi Sunak warning of the idea of Keir Starmer, in his words, being propped up by the SNP, Lib Dems and Greens.
Well, given that we've had conservatism of chaos ever since 2019, I don't think it's actually going to frighten people. People might even think a hung parliament might create a degree of consensus on important, actual, practical national things and discourage MPs from having to resign all the time or lose the whip for sending dick pics of themselves around. So I don't think it's... I mean, you have to admire the man for carrying on fighting. You know, I always admire people who carry on fighting when, you know, carry on bailing when the boat's going down. But I don't think it's going to be an effective kind of campaign. Rachel know better than me, probably.
Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, I just think the problem with it is it's not true. So it depends on this. It depends on an analysis of the local election results, which projects onto a general election, which is a completely different kind of vote. So the proportion in this vote, national vote share projection that goes to smaller parties and the Liberal Democrats is really unlikely to be come into effect at the general election. So they've got 23% of the electorate voting for smaller parties and 16% voting for the Liberal Democrats. Now, Labour's very likely to outperform that at the general election. And almost as, if not more importantly, this doesn't include Scotland, and it bases the Scottish bit of its projection on the last general election when Labour only won one seat. And given what's happened to the SNP since then, it's incredibly unlikely, or most people think they'll win a lot more than one seat. They could win 20. So it's just, you know, if Rishi Sunak really does think this, he's living in cloud cuckoo land. It's not true. So, he's treating his MPs, if he's trying to persuade them this is the reality, or the voters that this is the reality, then he's not being serious about it.
So the other thing that occurred to me, Libby, and I mean, it was always amazing the Tories managed to pull it off in 2015 after, you know, warning of a coalition of chaos under Ed Miliband, was the period of coalition that we've actually had between 2010 and 2015 was pretty stable. I mean, people argue about the policy they pursued, but they said they were going to pursue austerity. They said it was going to last 5 years, Conservatives and Lib Dems in government, and that's what they did. And actually, given everything else has happened since, Libby, people might look back on that period as a period of calm, having a coalition and two parties working together.
Well, this is just why I'm saying, you know, we've had conservatism of chaos and endless internal disagreements. And the idea that there might have to be, simply because it's the only way to get anything done, some degree of consensus, some degree of, you know, of giving up on heavy-duty ideologies and thinking what might work, you know, for stuff to be done immediately now, that might be quite attractive. I was terribly in favour of the idea of coalition when it first began, at the very, very beginning, when we first knew it. I started wearing deliberately odd socks every day as a sort of gesture of solidarity with the coalition. One has to do something, you know. coalitions can work. They're all across in other countries. They have worked in the past. It's not the end of the world. I think the coalition, the chaos thing means the idea that you'd have a few sort of scrappy SNP and Green and so on, that you'd get a kind of confusion. But I don't really think that's going to happen. I think Rachel's right there.
But also, I think all parties are coalitions. So Rishi Sunak's presiding over a coalition of chaos within the Conservative Party, which includes Suella Braverman on the one hand and Damien Green on the other. But the thing about the Lib Dem Conservative coalition was that the ground rules were all set. So everyone agreed to certain things they were going to achieve. But the problem with the sort of within one party coalition is that there are no ground rules. It's every faction for itself, and they're all fighting like cats in the sack.
And the other thing that occurs to me, Rachel, is that if you say we're heading for a hung parliament with Keir Starmer propped up by all these other parties, I mean, if you look at the polls, the logical thing to do in that, if you don't want chaos, is to return Keir Starmer with a majority, because Rishi Sunak doesn't appear to be suggesting that he's going to be the biggest party. So easiest way to avoid a coalition of chaos is to give Labour a majority, which, again, I'm not sure is a message that Rishi Sunak wants to land.
No, he seems to be admitting that the Conservatives have lost the election effectively, that, you know, they're not going to be in charge. In some ways, a more powerful argument could be vote Conservative to stop Keir Starmer having a landslide so that there's a sort of more balanced parliament. But I'm not sure he wants to say that.
Yeah, but we'll see if this... I mean, it does feel as if he's sort of churning his way through the various responses to... the local election results. This is just where he's ended up. I want to also slightly talk about the way that politicians react in the face of defeat. So this was Andy Street, the Conservative, after he lost the West Midlands mayoralty.
It has, of course, been my honour to serve and to lead this place for the last 7 years. I hope I've done it with dignity and integrity. In a sense, I can have done no more than that. It has been a great pleasure, great privilege. But tonight, I just want to say thank you and good night.
That was graceful in defeat. Susan Hall's concession speech, where she was the Conservative who lost to Sadiq Khan in London, was a bit different.
The thing that matters to them most, and to me, is reforming the Met and making London safe again. I hope Sadiq makes this his top priority. He owes it to the families of those 1,000 people who have lost lives to knife crime under his mayoralty. And I hope too that he stops patronising people like me who care. This isn't an episode of The Wire. This is real life on his watch.
Susan Hall there, still fighting the wall after defeat. What did you make of that, Libby? I mean, you have to. I mean, if you've been campaigning for a long time, it does take a lot to be gracious in defeat.
Well, and she did apparently reach out to shake his hand, and he snatched his hand away or turned away from her. Is that not right as well? I mean, I think to go on stating what she passionately believes in is fine, and she did attempt a handshake, so not so bad.
What do you think, Rachel?
I just thought she came across as petulant. She sort of said Sadiq Khan should do better. Rather than accepting the result graciously, as Andy Street did. The other person who I thought was so impressive was Andy Street's rival, Richard Parker, who won the mayoralty in the West Midlands. He actually began by praising the job that Andy Street had done. And there is, I think the voters really like the politicians who can rise above the partisan politics. And sort of they both Richard Parker and Andy Street, they seemed as if they cared about their area and the voters more than their own careers, whereas I thought Susan Hall came across as just thinking about herself and, you know, her reputation in relation to Sadiq Khan. The sort of personal attack, I think really one of the reasons that the mayoralties have been so successful is because they have created these figures who are champions for their regions and their areas. Rather than for their party. So you have Ben Houchen, you know, accidentally on purpose forgetting to wear a blue rosette even to town, deliberately distancing himself from the Tory party. That was the only reason he won, basically. And so I think that the less partisan, the better, and the more dignified, the better. And I think the voters love that.
Yeah, it is interesting that the mayoralties outside London seem to, whatever party, do seem to have captured that slightly better than London. It does seem to have been, before and after, just more angry and partisan. But maybe that's because it was a close, you know, people thought it might have been close and it was, you know, the stakes are high. Libby, I just want to talk about your column today. You've written about student protests, comparing what's happening today with students barricading themselves into universities and protesting what's happening in Gaza with the protests in 1968.
Well, it's one of the advantages of being ancient is that I do remember 1968. I came of age in 1968. Some people under the line, as usual, are missing the point entirely and thinking I'm saying that no campaign ever works. That's not what I was saying. Plenty of them obviously have done. But what I think does not work is the sort of the hurling marbles under police horses' hooves and so on, which a lot of my acquaintances did at university, and the screaming bigotry, the refusal to debate, and these enormous self-indulgent, self-promoting encampments. I just don't think they do any good. The particular thing, I mean, the big moment in it, which I mention, is when Michael Stewart, Foreign Secretary, came to the Oxford Union I was one of the officers of the Oxford unit at the time, God help me. And it was a complete nightmare. And what I saw at the age of 20 was this sort of little, rather determined, nervous, balding man. He was a Fabian, he was a peacemaker and so on, trying to make a coherent argument while being screamed at by hundreds of my contemporaries and someone who apparently later worked for the BBC dropping a noose, you know, and shouting, hang him from the gallery. And I just remember at that moment thinking, no, I don't want to be part of that kind of politics ever. You know, argue all the way, campaign all the way. And I think it's the screaming and shouting and the yelling, the American campuses, you know, sort of Zionists out, Zionists die, all the rest of it, which repels me so much that I wanted to write this piece. And as I say, some people think I'm saying, oh, so the suffragettes did nothing then, you know, which is not the point.
I thought it was a great piece. I mean, particularly my favourite bit was you discovering that you'd once written a letter to the Times.
It's embarrassing. I know it's embarrassing. It's not a bad letter. I was going through the Times archive to make sure I had the dates right. Suddenly I hit a letter from someone I knew, who was an old friend, now dead, Ros Stott, who was on the other side. She was in favour of shrieking at Michael Stewart. And then suddenly up came another one. It was from me. And I totally had forgotten that piece of student pomposity. I would like you to know, I mean, you're a nerd yourself, a political nerd. I was not one of them. I was not one of those people who wrote letters to the Times to get a letter in the Times. Honestly, I am so ashamed.
Well, all I can say is, Libby, I never wrote a letter to the Times, and you did, so I'm not going to be...
Well, yeah, they never printed it.
Now, let's turn our attention to a row which has erupted in the letters pages of the Times. It all started with Lord Lisvane, former clerk of the House of Commons, now chairs the Royal College of Organists. Well, he said, we're fortunate in this country to have such a splendid repertoire of hymns. English, Welsh, Anglican, nonconformist, mighty, joyous, reflective, peaceful. Why then, he said, do we all have to suffer this? He went on to say, All Things Bright and Beautiful is chosen by about half the participants in the weddings he plays for. I find the saccharine doggerel combined with the jingly tune deeply depressing, especially when there were so many wonderful alternatives. Well, wading into the row today, former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Williams, Rowan Williams, has told the Times, many of the hymns sung at weddings and funerals today are bland songs chosen just because people remember them from primary school. He said that so many great classics with imaginative and thought-provoking lyrics, but they've fallen out of common memory because they're not sung in schools with football or rugby matches. So let's start first of all. Libby, do you like or Creatures Great and Small? That's an entirely different question. All Things Bright and Beautiful.
Oh, it's all right. Purple-headed mountain, river running by. All that is quite nice. But no, I'm not mad about it. There are so many better hymns. I can tell you of many.
What do you think, Rachel?
I am all in favour of All Things Bright and Beautiful. I think if you're going to have hymns, a bit of saccharine doggerel and jingly tunes, exactly what you want. And it's all about sort of nostalgia, recalling primary school is actually rather a reassuring thing. So I'm very much in favour of All Things Bright and Beautiful.
I mean, the complaint that everyone chooses it for their wedding, isn't it? The reason for that is because there's nothing worse than somebody who chooses a niche hymn for their wedding, which is accompanied by total silence from the congregation. You want the hits, don't you, Libby, so that everyone joins in?
No. I think people don't invite the kind of people to your wedding who don't know the words of the hymns. It's terrible. Do you want to know what the best hymns are?
Yes.
Well, obviously, Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, because you get to roar out about tempest, storm and fire and then go very quiet for the still small voice of calm. So that's dramatic. But, of course, there is the Lighthouse hymn. Nobody knows that. It comes from Sankey's Sacred Songs and Solos. I found it in the Western Isles in a book, and then I looked it up. And it's lovely. It goes, brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse evermore. But he leaves within our keeping all the lights along the shore. Trim your feeble lamp, my brother. Send a glimmer across the wave. Some poor struggling, fighting seaman you may rescue, you may save. It's all about how everybody should be good and not just rely on God to do it all.
Very, very good. Rachel, do you want to give us a rendition of your favourite hymn?
I certainly don't, but I would add to All Things Bright and Beautiful, which I think should be up there, despite all the criticisms, obviously Amazing Grace, but there are many, many people who've sung that way better than me, so there's absolutely no way I'm going to sing it.
We've got a version of Amazing Grace, haven't we, that we can play in the absence of Rachel? Even Barack Obama's version was spectacular. He sang that without any accompaniment. We've had messages. Dominic says favourite hymn "When We Are Tempted" by Elizabeth Cosnett, written for Holy Humour Sunday. And where's someone else? "Dear Lord and Father," played by the GUS band, is a beautiful hymn, says Kieran. So people do have views. I personally think if you want people to sing, you need to make sure they know the tune. There's nothing worse than people picking their way through an unknown lyric and an unknown tune at a wedding. I'm not sure anybody really wants that, Libby.
Well, I don't know. Perhaps you should have a rehearsal. They have a rehearsal at my niece's wedding of everybody saying, you know, they were asked, you know, will you support these couple and their marriage together? And we've all had to shout out, "We will," in a really loud, menacing voice. We rehearsed that. And it was rather good because you sort of thought, yeah, this young couple knows that any ructions in their marriage, we should all be round talking them through. We will. We will. It was terrifying.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester, of course, you can read them in the Times every week with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, it's another exit interview.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The Big Thing.
We've already said.
Craig Whittaker is leaving us soon.
Goodbye.
Born in 1962 and raised in Australia, he's been the Conservative MP for Calder Valley since 2010, as more than 100 MPs announced they're quitting at the next election. And his exit interview reflects on nearly 15 years in Parliament. Recalls first working with Liz Truss 2 decades ago.
She's bright, she's articulate with her mind, and I thought she'd go far in the party.
Reveals the pressure of having a stalker in his life.
I mean, we've had 2 already gone to court this year. Last year I had a stalker. Now that was frightening.
And delivers his verdict on his former bosses, including Boris Johnson.
Lunatic.
And Rishi Sunak.
Steady Eddie.
So, Craig Whittaker, thank you for joining me for your exit interview. A chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. First question, why are you leaving?
Well, when I came to Parliament, I only ever envisaged doing 2 terms. I'd done 30 years in retail before, so I've now done 4 terms, and I'm getting older. I'm not old by any stretch of the imagination, but after the 2019 general election, I decided this would be my last term.
Has the political outlook, the state of the polls, the prospects of individual Conservative MPs, but also the prospect of a Conservative government receding, has that played any part in your calculation?
None whatsoever. No. You know, if you're a hard and fast politician like I am locally, you do it for very different reasons. And I've always done it to be a good constituency MP. But, you know, 14 years is a long time. It's a 7-day-a-week job. It's a lifestyle more than a, you know, traditional job. People still knock on the door at 10 o'clock at night, and people still stop you when you're buying a pint of milk and it takes 3 hours to do it. you know, there comes a time when, you know, I'm in my 60s now. I want some me time for me and my wife.
Let's talk about how you got into politics, because you talked about being in retail.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say these days, well, everyone, you know, they're all professional politicians, they've all worked as spads or whatever beforehand. You've got an interesting background. Born in the UK, emigrated to Australia at the age of 5, then came back in your 20s. Then you went into retail before you got into politics. How did you go on that journey? And do you, what impact do you think growing up in Australia had on you and your politics?
Well, huge, really. You're absolutely right. We did emigrate to Australia when I was 5. My family were £10 bombs. My dad was a boilermaker. My mum a seamstress. And they went to Australia to follow that dream. It was, you know, 1960s. Britain still hadn't recovered anywhere near the level that working class people could enjoy things after the war. My dad had this dream to go off to Australia. So we did that. I came back here when I was 20 on holiday, met my first wife, and the rest is history, as is my first wife. I grew up there. I went to school there. It's, I don't know whether I still call it home, but I do go every year. My mum's still alive. My dad's not alive anymore. My son lives there. I have a grandson there. So it is still very much a part of my life. So, Australia plays a big part in that.
And what about politics? Did it, because, you know, people's perception of Australian politics is it's pretty hardcore at times.
You know, have you not been in Westminster?
And actually, you know, maybe more to the right sometimes of what we might see British politics. Do you think it shaped your politics growing up in Australia?
Well, my dad was a left-wing shop steward in the Boilermakers Union. When, in fact, one of my first jobs at the age of 6 or 7, in those days, the men in the shipyards where my dad worked used to get paid cash. There was no bank accounts like we have today. So on a Friday, they got paid, and my dad's job was to collect all the union dues. He'd come home, my mum would go to work, then he'd have a sleep after tea, and my job was to write up all the receipts for all the union dues that had been paid from my dad's rough notes. So that was great when I was early. As I got older, I started to challenge some of my dad's ideals. And ironically, when he retired, I used to go to, I still go to Australia every year to see my mum, but I used to go when my dad was alive too. And we used to sit on the back balcony for 2 weeks arguing about politics. So my dad shaped my politics, not to his politics, of course. Without question, we had a very political upbringing.
It's so interesting doing all these exit interviews. Sometimes people inherit their parents' politics, yeah. And sometimes the exact sort of reaction to it.
Yeah.
And it just seems to change person by person. Before you got into Westminster yourself, is it right that you helped the 2005 general election candidate in Calder Valley?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I started out in politics at parish council level, Heptonstall Parish Council. I was on there for 5 years, and I was chairman of the parish council. And then I won't say progressed, because every level of democracy has its own little idiosyncrasies. But I then went on to the borough council, and I was a councillor there. And I was chairman of the Conservative Association at the time of the 2005 general election, and Liz Truss, which is what you're looking for, was our candidate. We deselected the candidate that stood for us in 2001, a lady called Sue Catling, and the party had imposed 5 candidates for the association to choose, and they chose Liz Truss.
Did you in 2005 think this is a future prime minister?
No, I don't think I did. But, one thing is for certain, and one thing I did learn about Liz is that she's an incredibly bright lady, despite all the ridicule she's currently getting. She's bright, she's articulate with her mind, and I thought she'd go far in the party.
So you then, she obviously didn't win and went off and got a seat in Norfolk. So you then got elected in 2010.
Yeah.
What was that like coming in, you know, a change election? We don't get them very often, you know, when there is actually a change of government brought about by an election. Coming in 2010, as a Conservative MP, a Conservative-led government, but a coalition. What was that like, being part of that intake?
Well, it was interesting. I said to you before about different levels of democracy being very different. I'd never experienced Westminster before. I think I'd only ever visited once before, very briefly. I didn't even get a tour. So it was all new. It was an adventure. I always remember from those days, the night when we were in committee room 14, and William Hague came in and introduced the new Prime Minister, David Cameron, and the euphoria that was around was something I don't think I've ever experienced, anything quite on the same level. Understanding the gravity and the enormity of what needed to be done going forward.
Let's look at some of the sort of the staging posts along the way then. So we actually joined David Cameron's time as Prime Minister. In fact, there was an anniversary just marked recently on the issue of same-sex marriage. I think it was 10 years since the law came into force. You were one of those who argued against that.
Yes.
On the basis, at the time, you said it could lead to eventually supporting polygamy or three-way marriages. It was more than a decade ago now. Do you think, with hindsight, you got it wrong, or do you think your concerns have been borne out?
Well, it's interesting because I argued quite a lot of things back then, and it's interesting that people like the press and yourself pick up on that one little quote, which was probably not the right thing to argue on at the time. But, you know, you've got to understand what we were doing at the time, in my eyes, was we were changing the definition of marriage. You know, you can change definition, you can say something's black and actually it's white in definition, but the reality is it's still black and white. So for me, it was about changing the definition of marriage. In our law at that time, the definition of marriage through Canon's law was that marriage was about the procreation of children between a man and a woman. So I believed way back then, and I still believe, if you believe that definition of marriage, that objecting to it was the right thing to do.
Do you concede now that actually lots of the warnings that were issued at the time haven't come to pass, and actually there are now thousands of gay couples who are quite happily married, and you know the world hasn't stopped turning? And
well, I'm not sure what the warnings were, Matt. I mean, the reality is we changed a definition of what marriage was. That's what we did. Yeah. And you know, I accept we've done that, and you know that's changed in law, and we crack on with that. But the reality is it politicians' right to change a definition of something? Yeah. And I will also point out at the time as well, what we were also doing is we were making the majority the minority, because let's not forget they could gay couples could have civil marriage, which you know heterosexual couples couldn't. So all of a sudden there were more avenues to tie the knot. People argued at the time that actually it was about legality. There was you know, Tony Blair had already done that prior when we had civil partnerships. You know, life moves on. It's 10 years ago and we are where we are.
The other big sort of row around the sort of actually ran a similar sort of time for David Cameron while he was doing that on one front. The issue of what is now known as Brexit, but your scepticism was bubbling up. You were one of the 79 Conservative MPs who supported the original rebel motion calling for a referendum on the EU, which eventually, now rerunning the whole of history, led to David Cameron promising one. Then it was in the manifesto in 2015. Did you, that night you walked through the lobbies to vote for that, did you think that we were setting off on a path which led to Brexit?
Yes, is the answer. I think the pressure, and it did get more and more. You know, I've been knocking doors in the Calder Valley for 30 years, and I can tell you there isn't one doorstep that you knock on prior to the Brexit vote that some of the fundamental issues that people were talking to about came from the EU. They never actually said Brexit. Of course they didn't, because nobody knew what it was at the time. But, you know, whether it was immigration, whether it was, you know, exchange rates, all those types of things that people talked about on the doorstep, there was always bubbling below the surface. So the reason I voted and wanted a referendum, because actually I wanted to put it to bed once and for all. I don't believe at the time I ever thought that we would come out of the EU, but I thought, without question, the question needed to be put.
You campaigned for Remain in the end, is that right, in 2016?
I voted Remain, yeah.
Do you think it was a mistake having the referendum and then having Brexit?
No, not at all. Look, you know, Brexit, what I've come to understand is Brexit is an evolving process. Brexit will be as good as the people of the UK make it. You know, it's not for politicians to tell business people how to run business. If you look at the Calder Valley has 19% of people in the Calder Valley work in manufacturing. And every single door that I go to and knock on in manufacturers in the Calder Valley have full order books. They're doing really, really well. We've just become the fourth largest exporter in the world. You know, you won't see the press reporting that too much. But there are some real good benefits of Brexit if we choose as a nation to grasp them. What won't help us as a nation is if we keep running over the same arguments, yeah, which is what we see happening.
Running, yeah. 2016 is a long time, yeah, ago now. Tell us about how you sort of approached the job as a backbencher and then sort of getting on the front bench into the ministerial government ranks. Which did you prefer doing?
Well, it was interesting. When I was first elected to Parliament, it was, you know, the first time I'd been to Parliament.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd been a councillor for such a long period of time, I kind of reverted to type, and I became a bigger councillor, if you will. Yeah. So we vote on committees, and I went on the Education Select Committee because prior to that, I was the lead member for Children's Services in Calderdale. It was where my comfort zone was. So I really enjoyed doing the committee work. It was great. But then there comes a time when you think, okay, I need to do something different. And that happened for me in 15. And Julian Smith was my whip at the time. And I know for a fact that he said you would make a great whip, but you need to go off and be a what we call a PPS, Parliamentary Private Secretary, which I did for a year, and then I went into the whip's office. And having a bellwether seat like the Calder Valley, you have to work as hard in the Calder Valley as you do down here. So that's why I say to you, it's like a 7-day week job. So I've always treated them as two separate things, and I've loved being in government. I've never been in government apart from being in the whip's office. I've been in there a few times over the years, and I love the whip's office, and I've had some pretty darn good jobs in my time that I've thoroughly enjoyed. But I can absolutely tell you being in the whip's office is the best job ever.
Now tell listeners why that is, because it's still the part of Westminster which is probably the least understood. People think of House of Cards and all of that. And also the fact that if you're a whip, you don't speak in public. So it's only after the event that we find out, you know, sort of what's going on. Take us inside the whip's office. Why was it the best job?
Well, ironically, if you become a parliamentary undersecretary of state or a minister, it's quite a lonely job because you probably meet the other ministers in the department once a week, but it's you and your civil servants in your department. That's it. In the whip's office, you operate as a team. And because, you know, I worked in retail for 30 years, it's very much team operated. So I think that's why I enjoyed it so much. It's good comradeship. You know, you've got lots of support in there. If you're having problems with somebody will say, oh, hang on, give such and such a call because they know how to deal with this or what have you. So it's a great networking place to be as well. You know, people think, you mentioned the House of Cards, people think it's all about bashing people up and making sure they vote the right way. That's not the case. There's so much to the whip's office. You know, you're a minister within a department as well, not to do policy, but what you do is when that department has a bill, it's your job as the whip in that department to grab it and get it through the parliamentary processes. You learn so much about parliamentary processes in the whip's office because, you know, that's what dictates your everyday life. You know, the running of the floor of the house, sitting in the chamber and just watching and understanding what's going on, making sure the opposition don't hijack something, making sure your own side doesn't hijack something, more to the point. You know, so there's lots and lots of different activities that go on in there. And of course, the biggest thing you are is, you know, you do have a flock, what we call a flock of people that you encouraged to vote the right way, but you're also quite often the social worker as well. People forget MPs are like everyday people. You know, we have the same issues. We have marriages, divorces, you know, sick family, parents who are dying, all those things that happen in everyday life. And a whip tries to help and manage that process with the individual MPs as well.
Do you think, given it was back in 2015 when Julian Smith first approached you when he was the chief whip, do you think MPs are getting more rebellious, more independent-minded, more self-centred in the, I want everything my way or not at all, the, you know, I don't quite like this, so we should get rid of the leader. It's all got very volatile, I suppose, is the word. Has the mindset of MPs changed? So it's more about them than it is about the collective group?
You've got a lot of MPs that don't have a backbone. I'll go as far as saying that. I mean, the problem today is social media. You know, even when I first started in 2010, social media was only just kind of, I think we had Facebook.
Yeah.
It was just ticking off. We still got mail that was like a foot high through the traditional letterbox. Now, you know, my office gets 2,500 emails a week as a minimum. So it's a very, very different thing. So I think MPs are under a lot more scrutiny, you know, good and bad, because quite often with these pressure groups, these campaigns, it's quite often he who shouts loudest. Doesn't mean to say it's the majority view. And a lot of MPs don't quite understand that, I think. So I think they're pressurised into doing things they wouldn't normally do if they were loyal. And I think that's part of the process as well. But, you know, the Conservative Party is not the only party that's happening to.
No, that's why it's MPs in general.
Yeah, absolutely. MPs in, I mean, you know, if you speak to any of the Labour MPs, they're under very, very similar types of pressure. And it's even worse if you're a female, unfortunately, because, you know, these keyboard warriors, whilst they attack us men generically, for some bizarre, strange reason, they seem to think that women are easier targets, and it's awful.
It's one of the things that's come up a lot, actually, during the exit interviews, has been the threats, the menacing behaviour towards MPs. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had two already gone to court this year.
This year, yeah.
Last year I had a stalker. Now, that was frightening. Well, I say it was frightening. I didn't know I had a stalker. But it came about, this woman apparently wanted to marry me. She'd written 70 journals all about me. She knew where my kids lived. She had the addresses of my children. She knew my wife's name. She bought a wedding dress and had it hung up in the loft. And, you know, in these journals, I mean, she's locked up now. She's you know, mentally ill, yeah. Obviously. Not because she wanted to marry me, Matt, of course. But that was quite frightening. Not particularly for myself, but for my family. You know, whilst I'm down here in Westminster, my wife's at home by herself.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I'm often on the phone and the doorbell will go and there'll be somebody wanting to speak to me. And it's quite late at night. And, you know, if people really thought about it honestly and openly, they probably wouldn't do it. But I think because I've been involved in the community for so long, they almost feel as though they can. So whilst I find it okay, well, no, I don't, but whilst I would accept it.
But the pressure, it's come up a lot, the impact on family. The other thing that's come up actually a few times is people saying that when they've shared their own individual experience, other MPs come up and say, well, I've had a similar thing. We don't really know. I think that some have suggested even the Speaker should sort of commission some research to sort of pull it all together. We don't even know all the gory details, but just the scale of arrests, charges, convictions of people threatening, abusing, stalking MPs.
I'm not sure. What purpose would it serve?
Yeah.
You know, it's all right doing all these things, but unless there's a purpose at the end of it, then, you know, okay, we may be letting the public know that MPs get, I don't know, 100 threats a year or whatever it is. But what's the use? What's the purpose? It could go the other way. It could make people do it more often. Well, if it's okay for them to do it, I'll do it too. I mean, quite often a lot of the stuff comes from keyboard warriors at 1 o'clock in the morning after they'd had a bottle of wine or, you know, been out on the lash.
Yeah.
And it still doesn't make it acceptable. I mean, some of these people who I know they are, because some are so stupid to put the names and addresses on it as well. You know, I've seen one or two of them in the street and they come up and talk to me as though everything's fine. So it's this keyboard warrior thing, you know, it's almost like a barrier there that they don't, in the brain doesn't commute, that's, you know, actually
it's the same thing.
This is the same thing.
Let's go back to your time in the Whip's office.
Yeah.
Perhaps the most momentous night of your role in the Whip's office. 2022.
Yep.
Liz Truss has been Prime Minister by this point for, what, about 4 weeks? It's 4 or 5 weeks?
27, yeah.
There's a big vote happening in the House of Commons on fracking. Mm-hmm. There's some confusion as to whether or not this is a matter of confidence or not. You know, in the twisting of arms to get MPs to vote for it, is it a question of confidence in the government if you don't vote for it? And I think it's fair to say there was chaos. There were reports of people being manhandled into one lobby or the other. Wendy Morton, who is your boss as the Chief Whip, was asked by one person how to vote, replied, "I don't know, I'm no longer the Chief Whip." And this is why I want to ask you, because it's always good to get it from the horse's mouth. You were witness coming out of the lobby and saying, "I am f***ing furious and I don't give a f*** anymore." Is that right?
That's correct.
What happened?
Well, that last bit you said is correct.
Yes.
Well, basically, it was a textbook whipping day. The operation was absolutely spot on throughout the day. Obviously, a highly contentious vote on fracking. Labour had pulled an absolute blinder by putting that down, knowing full well that we were divided on it. But, you know, from a Whip's point of view, it was textbook. We'd got Jacob Rees-Mogg and we'd got his ministers over from the department. They were upstairs. All the Whips were calling the relevant flock members, asking them how they were going to vote. If you were in my flock and you told me, Matt, that you were voting against, I'd arrange for Graham Stewart or Jacob Rees-Mogg to sit down with you, have a chat with you and talk you through it. We knew by the end of the day that there were six definites and two possibles that would vote against us. We knew that without question. But half an hour before the vote, the number 10 machine decided they were going to interfere in a whipping operation. And Wendy called me to the office at about half an hour before the vote and said, "Number 10's been on the phone. They want us to drop it from being a vote of no confidence in the government. And what do you think?" And I said, "Absolutely not. Which government in the right mind hands control of the order paper to the opposition on any day? Trust me, it's a vote of confidence." So we called the Deputy Prime Minister, Therese Coffey. She came down and we made it very, very clear this wasn't going to happen. In the meantime, what we didn't realise was that Spads at number 10 had called the PPS on the bench and asked them to write a note to Minister Stewart, who was going through his summing up. And the instruction was to tell him that it was no longer a vote of conscience. Which, as you can imagine, when we've been whipping all day and speaking to people, pushing them, even the Prime Minister spoke to one or two people throughout the day, Deputy Prime Minister had been on board, everybody had been working hard to get this vote over the line. And so to have that happen to somebody who was quite emotional about it, you know, it caused a bit of an uproar, as you can imagine. That's where the chaos... There was nobody manhandled, by the way, and I know that for a fact because I was there.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened. The reason I said what I said was because Jacob came into the voting lobby and said, "What on earth's going on?" Because he'd been such a big part of the operation. And I explained to him, and he said, I will go and get Graham Stewart to do a point of order and put the record straight." So as I came out of the chamber, because the Deputy Chief Whip is always the last person out of the voting lobby, I went to the back of the Speaker's chair and I caught Graham Stewart's eye and I said, "Are you doing a point of order?" And he said, "No." So that's when I said what I said as I walked down towards the Prime Minister's office, who was waiting to see me.
And that was essentially the tipping point, wasn't it, for what ended Liz Truss's premiership? There was the arguments about the merits of the mini budget and the fallout of all of that, and whether or not she did sums added up, and whether or not she'd done the pitch rolling or whatever it might be, and she got rid of the Chancellor and a whole new thing. But then just the sense that you couldn't even do the day-to-day business of defeating a opposition day vote when you've got a decent majority. If you can't even get that through, then, you know, the show's over.
Well, we did get it through.
Yeah.
We can't get it through without having that circus. And ironically, we had six votes against.
Yeah.
You know, that was the final numbers when we'd done the analysis of those that were either slipped or that we'd agreed could go off or whatever.
So, you know, from a whipping operation point of view, it was a perfect day. Somebody at number 10 got the wobbles. I'm not saying it was Liz. In fact, I don't think it was Liz. I think it was the so-called advisors and took the decision to do what they did. But in regards to your question, let's not forget, you know, the Queen died 2 days after Liz became Prime Minister. So, you know, she wasn't actually Prime Minister or doing the day-to-day job for even less a period of time. I think the rot had already set in with the Tory party in regards to, you know, this. It started, ironically, with Brexit. And, you know, we had different groups holding the government to ransom. In Theresa May's day, of course, that's why she called the 19 elections. She wanted a bigger majority. That didn't happen. She got less of a majority, so it became harder. We had the paralysis of Parliament. And I think some of these people got a taste of it. And then, of course, we had Boris. And we all know what happened under Boris in regards to, you know, people getting and doing whatever they wanted to do. And by the time we got to Liz, I think the party was ungovernable.
Well, let's turn our attention then to some of the classic exit interview questions. We'll start by summing up your various bosses in a word. Can you sum up... We'll start with the first one, David Cameron, in a word.
Yeah, great guy. That's two words.
Time to take, great guy.
Yeah.
Theresa May, in a word.
A manager. I think Theresa was, you know, I think under normal circumstances, she would have been... In fact, I think history will show that she was deemed as being a good prime minister. But, you know, Brexit was a huge thing. You needed a leader. And I think Theresa was more of a manager than a leader.
She was then obviously replaced by Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson, in a word.
Lunatic.
I thought you were to say leader when you started saying that. Explain lunatic.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because somebody said to me the other week, you know, Boris was a great leader. Boris had the potential to be a great leader. Margaret Thatcher was a great leader. She had a huge majority too. The only difference is she did something with that majority and made a huge difference to our country. Boris had a huge majority and did nothing with that majority. In fact, he's whittled it down. And, you know, do I like Boris? Look, I have a lot to be thankful for Boris. He, you know, he was the leader that I got elected the last time with a massively increased majority on where I was in 17. You know, I'll always respect him as our prime minister and leader. But, you know, he was his own worst enemy.
To then be followed by Liz Truss. Liz Truss, in a word.
Doomed. I think her premiership was doomed from the start. I really do. I being in the whip's office, you see a lot of things that goes on. It's a bit like being somebody stood behind the bar serving you drinks. You know, everybody thinks because there's a bar there's this barrier.
But you see everything.
You see and you hear everything. Yeah. And that's a bit like being in the whip's office. And, you know, the things that I saw going on, from colleagues was diabolical. I'm not going to tell you what they are.
Do you mean people plotting against her?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And do you think it's in part because, and there's been this live discussion recently about who should choose the leader, because you essentially have, in the Conservative Party, the same is true of the Labour Party, you have a system where if it's party members, you can have someone elected as leader who a majority of your own party don't support. You know, Rishi Sunak was overwhelmingly supported by Conservative MPs, but Liz Truss with, so she sort of arrives hamstrung already. She has got a mandate, but just not from the people that she has to rely on every day.
And it's still an issue with some party members now that we've chosen a leader that hasn't gone through, you know, the membership actually rejected.
Yeah.
You know, so that is still a big problem. Look, you know, people even think the membership process is not democratic enough. But I think, without question, if we do away with the process we currently have where members don't choose our leaders, then we're in real trouble.
Finally, then, Rishi Sunak, in a word.
Steady Eddie.
Is he doomed in the same way, that there's just no way back from everything that's gone on before?
I don't buy that. I really, really don't buy that. And in fact, I don't believe the polls either. Look, Are we going to have an 80-seat majority? Absolutely not. But it is not beyond the realms of possibility that the Conservative Party may still be in government next time. The Calder Valley is a bellwether seat. It goes the way of the government. And I can tell you, because we knock doors every week in the Calder Valley, and I've been knocking for 30 years, so I do know how a lot of the people who live in my constituency think. Are they angry with the Conservative Party? You bet they are. Are they switching to Labour? Absolutely not. I think if anything sinks the Conservative Party or Rishi Sunak at the next general election, it'll be apathy. It'll be our biggest problem, not the Labour Party. Because, you know, when they're ranting about things that have happened in the Tory Party, you say, well, are you voting for Starmer? To which then you get another rant saying, you know, are you barking mad? You know, no, that ain't going to happen. I think if we're not careful, the one thing that will sink the Conservative Party will not be the Labour Party. It'll be apathy.
Let me ask you some classic exit interview questions. Which part of your job did you enjoy the least as an MP?
Oh, gosh. Those Monday meetings, meetings that, you know, particularly during the pandemic when we're doing everything on Zoom, everything just, you know, they just seem to be meetings for the sake of having a meeting. I've always hated those, whether it was in local government or national government. Without question, there are hours and hours of my life I will never get back.
Would you recommend the job to a friend or family or someone you cared about?
Yes, I would. Look, you know, despite how it has changed, ironically, I have just become the MP that has served the Calder Valley the longest. Prior to that, it was Donald Thompson who had the record. And Donald once said to me, he said, look, if you ever become an MP, he said, the best advice I could give you is get a good typist. He said, you'll get a couple of dozen letters a week, he said, and drop them off on a Friday, pick them up on Monday, sign them, job done. You know, that was that, you know, that's not that many years ago, really. And the reality is, it's still a privileged job to do. You know, helping people in the community when, you know, they never come to MPs when they've got nowhere else to turn, when they've tried every other avenue. And to see and get a result for those constituents, it's the most rewarding thing that you could ever do. And I think that's the same. It's the same for every MP. It's not just whether you're a Tory or Labour or whatever. I still get a real buzz out of helping people. And sometimes it's a simple call. You know, you pick up the phone, because guess what? You know, when an MP calls somebody, they pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Or writes a letter. They put it to the top of the pile instead of leaving it on the bottom. And to use that in a way that it really genuinely makes a difference to somebody's life is incredibly rewarding.
Final question then. What will you do next?
Ah, have you got another hour? I've always had this ambition to go off on my Royal Enfield motorbike and do the Silk Route.
Oh, wow.
Or the Silk Roads, yeah. Because there's several of them. So I've done a six-year plan. I'm doing two lots of 6 weeks a year. So I'm driving for 6 weeks, putting my bike in storage, flying home, going back later on in the year, doing another 6 weeks, and I'm literally going to do the Silk Route. The only problem is that there is so many countries at war, you can't get beyond Turkey at present. Well, you could, but being an ex-MP may not be a great, yeah. You know, Syria is not a great place to go. So I'm flying to India later on in the year. I did mention it was September to somebody on last week in an interview I did. And Twitterfield went mad saying the general election is going to be in September. Anyway, later on in the year, I'm flying to India. I've hired another Royal Enfield motorbike, exactly the same as mine. And I'm going to go and do Kashmir, Nepal, Bhutan, and Bangladesh, and that area of India. So I'm doing my first 6 week stint later on this year.
Wow. What a thing to look forward to. Well, Craig, really appreciate your time today. Craig Whittaker, Conservative MP for Calder Valley, thank you for joining us for your exit interview.
Man, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. I don't want to see you go, but darling,
you better go now. Interview there of Craig Whittaker, and you can catch up on all the previous Exit interviews by searching for Exit interviews wherever you're listening to this. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more.
And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.